All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies. This is our weekly exploration of the Torah portion. This week's Torah portion is Tetzaveh. And the focus of Tetzaveh is on the Big Day Kahuna. Not the Big Kahuna. The Big Day Kahuna, which means the priestly garments. So the Torah portion details, what were the garments that the regular priests wore? What were the garments that the high priest wore? What was worn on this special occasion, that special occasion, etc. When I say special occasion, I only mean because on Yom Kippur, as we'll see tonight, the high priest wore a little bit of a different garment setup. All of that we'll get to. But before we get to the garments, before we talk about the clothes, let's talk about the tanks. The tanks. Tank. Like a T-A... A tank? Well, not necessarily a military tank. A mitzvah tank. Who has seen a mitzvah tank?
Yes,
a mitzvah tank.
Yes.
Sarah, where have you seen a mitzvah tank?
In Atlanta.
Wesley Woods. What did it look like?
It was a truck with a
sukkah. Nice. Okay, good. Where did you see it? Also here?
Yeah.
Nice. Has anybody seen a mitzvah tank in Manhattan? I'm going to explain. Huh? Your son, wait, your son has?
Oh, yeah, my son actually called me once.
Oh, I think you told me this story. Yeah.
He's on his office at 6th Avenue, and he called me, and he says, oh, my gosh, there's all these kabash people jumping out of tanks. And
yeah, not real tanks, but yeah.
But a whole parade of...
Oh, yeah, that's probably on the Rebbe's birthday.
Yeah, like
they do that.
On 6th Avenue.
Yeah, like 90 of them. Let me explain what a tank is, a mitzvah tank. It's a good tank. It's not a negative tank. It's a tank that fires positivity, or not even fires. In Israel, there are also tanks.
Yes.
Both, the real tanks and mitzvah tanks. In the 1960s, so the Rebbe put out a call to take Judaism to the streets, street Judaism. Especially right before the Six-Day War in 1967, the Rebbe said, and we discussed this in a previous course that we had about the Six-Day War, the Rebbe called for men to put on tefillin. You got to get folks putting on tefillin, go out there, go to the street. Now, in Israel, this was huge. They went to all the soldiers, all the bases. It's just touching video and pictures of, you know, this old footage and pictures of the soldiers putting on tefillin. There's even a story I once heard about a guy who was not a religious fellow in the army, and it was around, I don't know which war it was, but it was in one of the wars, and Chabad guy is putting on tefillin with everybody, all the soldiers, and he says he doesn't want to do it. Doesn't want to do it. Everyone else is doing it. Finally, he says, okay, I'll do it. Puts on tefillin. Not so long after he put on tefillin, some sort of bomb happened, explosion, missile, whatever. It took off that arm that he put on tefillin on. And I think the story goes, he came to the Rebbe and he said, and I'm going to leave a cliffhanger because I don't remember what the Rebbe said, but he was so bitter over the fact that he finally did a mitzvah for God and put on tefillin on that arm, and that arm is the arm that was taken. You know, sometimes we think that when we do the right thing, we expect that the blessing should follow, and it doesn't always work out like that. The Breslov Rebbe once said, the Rebbe Nachman of Breslov, that a real test is when you pass the first test and things don't work out, right? So you're given a test and you pass the test, and then you're expecting like good things to happen and they don't happen. That's when you have the real test. Anyway, I don't remember the end of the story, which is probably why I shouldn't have brought it up if I don't remember the end of the story. But we can all look it up after the class. The point of this is that the mitzvah, so the Rebbe initiated this idea of taking Judaism to the streets, taking Judaism to the outside. And in Israel, this was a reality. In New York City, and other cities as well, in Atlanta, LA, Miami, Chicago, big cities, Pittsburgh a little bit. So what would happen is the yeshiva students, usually on Fridays or on holidays, would, like in the intermediary days of the holiday, the Chol HaMoed, they would rent RVs, like big RVs, retrofit them inside, nothing major, but get them all decked out with Jewish signage on the outside, Jewish books and tefillin candles on the inside, and you roll in with music blaring, loudspeakers, you rig loudspeakers on the outside, play Jewish music, and you just Jew it up. That's it. You just go all Jew all the time. And you blast the music. You go to, you know, you pull into to Manhattan. You park the RV, and you start asking people on the street, are you Jewish? Would you like to do a mitzvah? Put on tefillin. Here's some Shabbos candles. That's why Friday is a good day to do it. Otherwise, who's going to take Shabbos candles on a Tuesday, right? So this would be a Friday, typically a Friday activity. Or if it's a holiday, so you mentioned the sukkah mobile, the sukkah tank or the mitzvah tank for Sukkot. So you would have a sukkah, you know, maybe on the back of a truck or something. You would have a lulav and esrog handy. You know, you would have these things available. So bottom line is the mitzvah tank was a not only, I don't know, it is a way in which Judaism really gets out there. And I saw a wonderful, a great article on Chabad.org that kind of chronicles the history of the mitzvah tank. And it talks about how one of the things of the mitzvah tank is it gets people to acknowledge their Judaism in the middle of the street. It's like, excuse me, are you Jewish? And now a person is faced with an existential question. What are they going to answer? Like, wait a second. What happens if I say yes? Do I win something? Do I lose? Like, what exactly happens? So we're not telling you up front. We're just asking you the question. But it's really a moment in which it allows people the opportunity to really affirm their Jewishness. And it's incredibly, like, even that itself, of course, the mitzvah that follows is so beautiful and wonderful. But even the question, which not everyone responds, you know, well to the question. I remember back in the day, I got some pushback. Usually it's yeshiva students that man these tanks. But anyway, yeah.
Well, just very quickly, I think I told you the story. My son and daughter-in-law were approached. And anyway, they asked my daughter-in-law, are you Jewish? Yes, okay. And you know, so, but then they asked my son, and they said, well, what's your last name? Well, I mean, you know, it's not a very Jewish name. And they said, oh, you're not Jewish. But what was really interesting, and you know the background of, I mean, it's not something that my kids were raised with a strong Jewish identity. All of a sudden, he found himself defending himself, saying, yes, I am Jewish. You know, like, it's such an interesting story.
Right.
Because now it became sort of like something he was really proud of in that moment, and he didn't want somebody to take it away from him.
They just set him up for that.
I know. What's your mother's maiden name? And he said, oh, you're Jewish.
All right, fine, approved.
Yeah.
So the mitzvah tank was, it started again in the 60s, in the 70s, it really was, it really kind of picked up steam, and then it's continued ever since. And typically every year on the Rebbe's birthday, usually in April, there's a big, I mentioned this before, there's a big mitzvah tank parade where you have upward, usually they if it's on a Sunday, if the Rebbe's birthday is on a Sunday, they usually go all out. And I remember for the Rebbe's 90th birthday, so they did, I think, 90 mitzvah tanks. 100 mitzvah tanks, you know, it's a lot of, huh?
Just in New York,
yeah, riding through Brooklyn and Manhattan.
Is it just like North Korea?
No, because they're not actually military tanks. And no one is standing in front of the tanks, or what was that? What's that iconic image of the guy standing in front, right?
Tiananmen Square,
yeah. Do you know that in China they don't know about that story? Tiananmen Square? They don't know about Tiananmen Square? Do you know that? Like, they don't have Google or something? I'm kidding. It's really locked down. Leah was there some years back helping out Chabad in, I want to say, not Shanghai, what's the other one?
Beijing.
I think it was Beijing. And the kids here didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, on television last night, on public television, they had a story about Anne Frank's diary, how universally it's read and loved, and they showed it being read in North Korea.
Oh, wow.
And the take that those kids have on Anne Frank.
Wait, North Korea or South Korea?
North Korea? They allowed them to read it, but it sounds crazy.
They didn't read it. They allowed it.
Yes.
But the interpretation that the kids draw from the Messiah.
Interesting.
Is just so twisted.
Oh, it's totally different of a...
I mean, they read the book, but their interpretation...
is based on how they're... Interesting.
I would like to tell the class that I'm not contagious. I have laryngitis.
Well, Adina Malka, we wish you a refuah shlema, and your voice should return very, very soon. Should be reunited with your voice. So there were those, however, that pushed a little bit back against the mitzvah tank. They weren't so happy with this whole mitzvah tank business. And some of the opposition came with the argument that it's safer for the Jews. Remember, hold on, this is like a few decades after the Holocaust. So it's safer for the Jews to not make such a big deal about themselves. Like, why are we going so out there? Why are we going to the streets? Let's keep it on the down low, this whole Jewish thing. That was one approach. There was another approach that said other segments of the Jewish community had a similar conclusion but a different take on it, saying, taking Judaism to the streets? You're taking the holy tefillin and you're wrapping people in the middle of Times Square? It's degrading to the mitzvah. The streets are treif. You know what that means? It's not kosher. How can you take a mitzvah, a beautiful mitzvah, and just put it out there like that? You have to reserve it for the synagogues, for the communities, for, you know. So different groups push back. And the Rebbe, of course, was aware of this. It was the Rebbe's call to do this, and the Rebbe was aware of this. So let's take a look. Let's jump right in and see how the Rebbe addresses the mitzvah tank pushback. Ooh, I think we are... Oh, look at that. Some already went around. Perfect. Pass this down, Ray. Pass this down. Debbie and Amy. Okay. Mike, please begin. Text 1, page 140. I am out. But, I have something even better. One second. This will work. I have a secret surprise. Here we go.
Oh my gosh,
in case
that's such a secret surprise.
You can use, see, secret surprise. Who saw that coming? All right, Mike, please read page 140.
Some raise the following argument. Listen, I can understand that the current situation of our generation calls for promoting Judaism. Of course, we cannot simply sit in our private chambers and wait for people to wander in and request, please teach me Torah. Rather, we must go out in the public square and seek out those who are far and bring them close. But why the need for such noise and publicity? Why is it necessary to go out into the streets and publicly call for Jews to don tefillin, affix mezuzah to their doors, and give charity? Who ever heard of such behavior in previous generations?
So the Rebbe is citing the claim against his own call in this talk. He says, people are asking, what kind of business is this? Who does this? Okay, fine, you have to be a little bit more outgoing. But to take it to the streets with such boldness and brashness, like the title of this class, bold, brash, braggadocious. What is braggadocious? That sounds good, though. That could be. It's been a while. I'm not well-versed in my Mary Poppins. So, to understand this a little better, let's turn to the discussion in this week's Torah portion. So please open up your Chumash to the beginning of the portion, which is Tetzaveh. You can find it in the Chumash.
533.
Thank you. What is it?
533.
So 532, 533. Tetzaveh begins with a discussion about the menorah and then quickly talks about the Kohanim, the priests, and the priestly garments. Now, last week, we spoke about the building of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, and the vessels inside. So we talked about the hardware, if you will. This week's Torah portion, we talk about the people that would serve in the temple and in the Mishkan, which are the Kohanim, and what they wore, the priestly garments. So we have here a discussion about the apron. I'm just flipping through pages. There's the settings in the breastplate. Then on page 540, 543, you have the robe, the forehead plate. 545, the tunic, turban, sash, and pants. And that kind of sums up the eight garments. Now, I want to draw your attention to the robe on page 543. The robe was a robe of blue wool that was worn by the Kohen, by the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And he wore this the entire time that he walked through the temple and he did the service or he was part of the service, etc. Now, there's a picture of it on 543. If you notice, the picture is not in color. But if it were in color, that would be a turquoise blue. Let's read this inside. Ray, please read about the robe on 543, that little section that says the robe. No worries.
Okay, the robe. You should make the robe worn under the apron entirely of turquoise wool. Its collar at the top should be hemmed inside, the work of a professional weaver, like the collar of a coat of armor. It must not be torn. On its bottom edge, you should make pomegranates, shapes of turquoise, purple, and crimson wool, all around the edge, and golden bells among them all around. A golden bell should be followed by a pomegranate, which is followed by a golden bell, then another pomegranate, and so on the bottom edge of the robe, all around. It should be on Aaron when he performs the service, and its sound should be heard when he enters the holy place before God and when he leaves, so that he will not die.
So that is, thank you. So here we have a description of the robe, which in the Hebrew is the me'il. The me'il is the robe, and it's made of blue, and it has this alternating pomegranate bell, I don't know what you would call them, design? Yeah?
Ornament.
Trim around the hem. Bling, right. Bling. Good. So, but the last verse there is very interesting. The last verse says that Aaron, who was the high priest, he shall wear this when he does his service. And then it adds, its sound shall be heard when he enters the holy place before God and when he leaves, so that he will not die. What does that imply? What does that imply?
Well, if anybody goes in without that, it won't be to them.
Right? Doesn't it? Right? He said, he should wear that when he's doing the service and when he's walking around, so that he won't die. That sounds like a veiled threat, right? In other words, if you don't wear it, then this, in fact, is what Rashi says. Take a look at text number 3b. Text 3b. Rashi uses classical logic, and he says the fact that the Torah says, if you wear it, you won't die, that implies if you don't wear it, you will. Text 3b. Julian, please read this one. 143.
I'll pass tonight.
You want to pass? No problem. Debbie.
From the implication of the negative, you infer the positive. If he will have the priestly garments, he will not be subject to the death penalty. But if he will enter the temple to perform the service without one of these garments, he will be subject to death at the hands of heaven.
Now, Rashi expands it to any of the garments. In other words, if you're missing any of the garments, if the high priest was missing any of these garments, it was a fatal act of disobedience. However, directly in the Torah's narrative, where is it written by? The robe, the me'il. And specifically when it comes to the robe, which feature is being highlighted? The bells and the sound that it makes. So it's not enough to have the bells, but its sound needs to be heard. Because if not, so that he will not die, which again implies that this could have fatal consequences if he fails to do so. Okay, so here's the question. The big question that we're going to ask is, we'll ask several questions. Number one, what is the big deal about the noise? Why do we need the noise? In other words, what is wrong with the sound of silence. What is wrong with the high priest doing the service quietly? Look what it says. It should be on Aaron when he performs the service, and its sound should be heard when he enters the holy place. We need to hear the sound. Why do we need to hear the sound? Let him perform silently and quietly. In fact, we have a text here from the book of Kings, which is a text that pertains to God's dialogue with the prophet Elijah, something that we've cited before in previous classes and in other settings. Nonetheless, it's instructive here. Amy, please read page 144.
The word of God then said, "Go out of the cave and stand on the mountain before God. And behold, God was passing, and a great, powerful wind, smashing mountains and breaking rocks, went before God. Elijah was told, 'God is not in the wind. After the wind came an earthquake. God is not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire. God is not in the fire. After the fire came a still, faint sound.' It happened that when Elijah heard this, he wrapped his face in his mantle, and he went out and stood by the cave's entrance. And behold, a voice spoke to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'"
And the narrative continues, and however that ends, it ends. The point here is, God is not in the wind, God is not in the earthquake, God is not in the fire. Where is God? In the kol demama daka, in the small, faint sound, small, quiet sound. Which tells us that, one might think, it tells us that, you know, that in the loud noises, that's not where you really find the truth. It's only in the still, quiet places. So therefore, the question is raised, why is the high priest needing to do his service with this bell ringing? What's the deal with the bells? Another question we need to ask pertains to Yom Kippur. And this is a very important question. Here we go. On Yom Kippur, the high priest changed from the 8 typical garments that he wore to 4 white linen garments. So let me explain this a little bit. The 8 garments the high priest wore had gold in it. Typically, the garments had some sort of gold in it. Let's see. What does the robe have? The robe has golden bells. But the 8 garments of the high priest, the other ones as well, they had some sort of gold thread or gold ornament, something of gold. There was a forehead plate that was made out of gold entirely. There were gold items that were worn by the high priest, which is not surprising because gold is, of course, a very precious metal. In fact, even in the Olympics, the most precious metal that's given out is the gold. So the high priest had gold. On Yom Kippur, when the high priest was doing the specific service for Yom Kippur, the high priest changed out of those 8 garments. He went to the mikveh, the ritual bath, took off those garments, and put on 4 white linen garments. He did this several times throughout the day because he alternated from the typical service to the special Yom Kippur service. And just so I just to explain for a moment, on the day of Yom Kippur, so it's not, he didn't only do the Yom Kippur service. There were also things that he had to do because it's a normal day. Every single day, certain things happen in the temple. On Yom Kippur, he did everything himself single-handedly. Usually there was a whole team of priests that were doing the service. On Yom Kippur, the one day of year, he did everything A to Z himself. So it was not only special for Yom Kippur, it was also services that were done the rest of the year. So when he did the regular service, he wore the regular garments, his 8 garments. But when he did the special Yom Kippur service, which is for atonement, he did not wear any gold. He only wore white. White, of course, is purity, and it symbolizes this idea of cleansing and atonement of sin. But also, it's a bad idea to wear gold on Yom Kippur. Why? What does it remind us of? The golden calf. So we want to stay away from any reminders of the golden calf. We're trying to get away from the golden calf, not running into the golden calf. So, he wore the white linen garments. The question is like this. If it's so important that the high priest wears the bells to ring in the temple when he's doing the service, Nu, what's the obvious question? So what happens in Yom Kippur? No bells. Right? Like, you know, they have those stores like no shoes, no shirt, no service. So he would have no bells, no service.
No bells, no whistle.
No bells, no whistles, no service, right? How do you... No bells, no sound, no service. You have to have the bells. The Torah says he has to have the bells. The sound shall be heard when you enter the when he enters the holy place before God, so that he will not die. Well, what's going on over here? Take a look at text number 5. Text number 5 is where we see about the garments of Yom Kippur. This comes from the book of Leviticus. Mike, it's all you.
With this shall Aaron enter the holy, with a young bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. He shall wear a holy linen shirt, and linen pants shall be upon his flesh. And he shall gird himself with a linen sash and wear a linen cap. These are holy garments, and therefore he shall immerse himself in water and don them.
How many garments are here mentioned here? What are they? Number one?
Shirt.
Linen shirt. Number two? Pants. 3? Sash. Number 4? The old linen cap. Classic throwback. Linen, the old white linen cap. Right? I'm picturing like a newsboy. These were the garments. Notice what's missing. The robe and the bells. He didn't wear it. Now, he wore it throughout the day, but he didn't wear it when he did the service in the Holy of Holies. When he stepped into the Holy of Holies, he was not wearing the me'il. He was not wearing the robe. No bells. So what's happening? We're making such a big deal about the bells. Don't go anywhere without the bells. Make sure we can hear you. We want to know what you're up to, right? Except in Yom Kippur, no bells. Not no bell. That's a different prize, but no bells. What's going on with that? I'm thinking now, of course, the old bell, Ma Bell. Right? The old telephone. Remember that?
Bell. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then they broke it up.
Mom and Dad Bell.
Yeah. And now they're buying each other again. It's great. It's great how things work, right? It's amazing. Anyway, right, no bell, no service. Who remembers, what was it, MTI, I want to say? What was that other phone long distance? MTC?
Oh, no. MCI.
Wow. Remember MCI? I'm sure you could do better than that. Wait, hold on. How much better can you do?
Party lines, where you can pick up and hear your neighbor talking on the phone.
Without them knowing?
If you're
really? Mike, tell us more. We're done here. Joking.
Joking.
No, but that's for a payphone, huh? But even in your house? No, who are you paying? You in your house, you paid money? Who got the money? Are you serious?
And then,
David says on the corner. No, I mean.
No, and then the man would come every month.
Collect?
In your black box and collect all the nickels.
No way!
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is wild. That's the coolest.
Did you have to share a line?
Wait.
Oh, no, you were too young. What?
Wait, who shared? You also shared? You didn't share a line? Hold on, but back in the day, didn't they have, like, you had to call the operator? Was this around by you guys? Or was that, okay. I don't know. I don't want to, like.
You can't call the operator, do long distance.
Right?
Sure.
And they would have a switchboard. They would, like, plugging things in.
And you could get information for free. You would just ask and they would.
Right.
Oh, yeah, remember that? You dialed 411 and you got information.
You know the story about the guy whose brother, was it 411 then also?
411.
Now we just Google it. You know the story about the guy, the brother who calls his brother? He says, listen, he calls him back in the day through the operator. It's like long distance. So he says, Yankel, it's Moshe. How's it going? Yeah, I fall under hard times. I need to borrow $1,000. Ah, I can't hear you. So they need to borrow $1,000. I can't hear you. The line is not a good line. I need to borrow $1,000. I can't hear a thing. The operator says, I can hear him clearly. He says, he needs to borrow $1,000. So Moshe says to the operator, then you give it to him. All right. Anyway, back to the class, already in progress. So, this was sponsored by MCI and Ma Bell, together again. So, the question here is, why is the high priest not wearing the bells? Now you're thinking about Right. Why is the high priest not wearing the me'il with the bells on Yom Kippur? Yes, I get it that it's, I understand that it's gold and he's not wearing any gold and all these four garments. But at the end of the day, if it's so important to have all this sound, you know, emanating from him as he walks through the halls and the areas of the temple, then why is Yom Kippur the exception? Now, let's jump into what the Ramban Nachmanides says about the bells and the sounds in text number 6. Classic explanation of the Ramban, 146.
The words and its sound will be heard when he enters the holy place is intended to explain the reason why there were bells on the bottom hem. They were not intended to be worn per se, nor was it an aristocratic design. Rather, its purpose was for the high priest to be heard upon entering the holy chambers. It was as though he was requesting permission from his master to enter, just as one would not enter the chamber of a king uninvited, lest he be liable to the king's death penalty, as we find in the story with King Ahasuerus.
So timely. Let's explain the Ramban. Ramban says, in his opinion, in my opinion, the bells did not exist as part of the garment, if you will. It wasn't a fashion statement. It wasn't about the garment. It wasn't about the look. It was totally about the audible function. It was about the sound that it was making. So he's saying, the Ramban is saying, that the high priest needed to announce his approach to the temple. Just like you don't just spring in on the king, "Oh, hey, I'm here. How, aren't you expecting me?" But you get announced, and you make sure that the king knows that you're approaching. So too the high priest with the bells, with his bell bottom. So it became heard. It became noticed that it was like the announcement that he was approaching. And then he cites, of course, the story of King Ahasuerus, and this is a reference to the Book of Esther and the Megillah, where Queen Esther is asked by her cousin, and some say her husband, Mordechai, to approach the king and work on this decree against the Jewish people. Work on this decree that was against the Jewish people to try to get it annulled. And she famously says to Mordechai, what does she say? "I haven't been called in 30 days, and I can't go unannounced. I can't just come uninvited." So nonetheless, she does, and the king miraculously extends the golden scepter, and she is accepted, and the king listens to her and grants her request for the various meals that she has with him, and then she ultimately points the finger at Haman, and that's when the story takes a favorable turn. The point of this is that the Ramban likens the bells on the me'il to announcing a visitor to the king, and therefore it's appropriate. Now, his answer doesn't address the question of why not on Yom Kippur. The question would still stand according to this. Well, then why not announce the one time a year you're going to the Holy of Holies, the rest of the year you don't go into that special chamber where the ark was, the one day a year that you're going to the Holy of Holies, and now you're not announcing yourself? It's like, "Hello, you've been waiting for me?" Like what's up with that? He doesn't explain that. And in addition, the question would be, if it was all about announcing his arrival, you would think, let him carry like a cowbell. Right? Let him carry like, right? Like they do when the skiers take off from the starting spot. You know what I'm talking about? Olympic referencing here. But you know what I'm talking about, right? It makes a little jing sound. Let him do that. Or take a triangle, one of those things. Let him, maybe a xylophone. I'm sure that's not how you play the xylophone. Help me out here, Marosara. How do you play the xylophone? There you go. That's what I meant. Xylophone. Right? This is more of a harp. Or not. It is a harp, right? Let him play let him play an instrument when he comes in the first time in the morning. Play the thing, announce your arrival. Gesundheit, everything's good. Why do you have to have to wear it the whole day? I'm here. Literally we've seen you for the last 4 hours. We get it. What's with the bells? Right? So what's going on with this? The Ramban's answer seems to be insufficient. If it's all about announcing your presence when you enter the chamber of the king, so do it once and be done with it. You don't need to wear it the whole day. Yeah.
Well, no one else was in the Holy of Holies.
Yeah, but he didn't even wear it into the Holy of Holies. That's the point.
Know,
yeah.
No one,
you're saying no one else was there. Yeah, but according to Ramban, according to Nachmanides, it wasn't about anyone else. It was about announcing himself before God God is the king. So it's announcing himself before God. So two questions. Number one, if that's the case, announce it the first time you show up in the morning. You know, the first time you enter the temple, do a little, kazatska, and that's it, and be done with it. Number one. Number two, why not then tell, it's kazatska, it's even a dance, it's the wrong word. Doesn't matter, it sounded right in the moment. And number two, why not wear it when he enters the Holy of Holies for the first time? That would be like the most appropriate time to wear it, because you're entering the chamber of chambers, the secret inner chamber of the king. Now you really need your bells on. Isn't that a phrase? Isn't that a phrase, something about bells on? Am I wrong here?
From a song?
No, like dressing with...
No.
With bell. No whistles. It is a phrase.
Yeah, it is a phrase, but I can't think of it. It's like...
Not the Hasidic group bells. That's something else.
It's like bells on your toes or something.
Yes, something. It's,
all right. We'll look it up. We'll look it up. I feel like if we were playing Trivial Pursuit, we would not be winning. We would not be winning right now.
I'll be there with bells on.
Okay. I'll be there with bells on. Mike, that's it. Takes the cake. Be there with bells on. And that's, who said that first? The high priest. The high priest. Except for Yom Kippur. I'll be there without bells on. What's going on? So here, let's get to the spiritual understanding of this. And this is an unbelievable idea. And I want to begin by talking about fire. This is one of my favorite analogies of Kabbalah and Chassidus. So picture two fires. You have the campfire. The campfire is made, you're burning logs. You have logs, campfire. You did it right. You had your, what's the small stuff called?
Tinder.
The tinder, the kindling stuff, right? And you had like, and you had twigs, and then until you built the whole pyramid thing. Who was a good, anybody here was a good fire builder?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were a fire builder?
Girl Scout.
All right. I always was on the lookout for bears. I'm kidding. I'm joking. No one does that anyway. Maybe people do.
You need the
marshmallow. Yeah, someone's got to like get the eats going.
At Camp Barney, they had the one match club where if you could get a fire going with one match. I did it once.
That's impressive.
It is impressive. I couldn't do it.
You're saying you have to build it right, so that all it takes is one match. Oof.
Yeah.
What about no match?
That would be
just like
two stones,
right? Flintstones. Dun, bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, dun, bum. Anyway, it's going to be a fun podcast to listen to.
People are going to just
turn. Oh, yeah, it's good. I lost them at bells.
Oh, yeah, they're going to say, this is Kabbalah.
Yeah, this is, what is Torah study? Since when? All right, so picture that fire. Picture the bonfire, the campfire. And then picture an oil lamp. Picture maybe a Chanukiah made of olive oil or any other oil lamp. I know it's not so common today to have oil lamps. You guys probably have light bulbs in your house, don't you? I'm sensing a light bulb crowd here, not an oil lamp crowd. But back in the day, they would have oil lamps. If you wanted to read at night, you're not lighting a crack. You're not lighting a wood log fire. You're lighting an oil lamp. So what is the difference? I started saying this before, but this is what I was actually saying, is when you light a log on fire, what does it sound like?
Crackle.
Crackles. It makes lots of noise. Right? Think about it. It pops. Mm-hmm. And then when it pops, it dramatically like shoots out
sparks
and embers. I don't know if they're called embers, but we're going with that angle. So it shoots out sparks and embers, and it's like, it's magical. But it's never still. It jumps. And it goes this way, and it goes that way, and it's making noise, it's animated, it's boisterous, it's rambunctious. Then you look at an oil lamp. You have oil, you have a wick. It's calm, it's serene. Everything is perfect.
Yeah.
It's still. It's not jumping. It's not jumping. It's just lit. So what's the difference? What's the difference? Kabbalah explains that the more attuned something is, I'll give you another example. You have the person who, God forbid, has fallen upon hard times, and they haven't had a good meal in a long time. And a wealthy fellow, sees this person and invites him to his house for a meal. Right? He says, come on in. Pulls out this lavish meal. 4-course dinner. I want you to picture what the scene will look like. They bring out the first course. They bring out a salmon, a tilapia, a sushi. The sushi is also a fish. A sushi. They bring out salads and breads and soup, the whole nine yards. What do you think our impoverished fellow is going to, how do you think he's going to be eating? He hasn't had a good meal in days. How do you think he's going to be eating? Yeah. There's going to be clamor. There's going to be some noise, some movement involved. The wealthy man who gets this every single day, how's he eating? Very refined, right? Very refined. Very dignified. So Kabbalah explains like this, that the more something is attuned to that experience, the quieter it is. And the less attuned it is to that experience, the noisier it is. It has to do with friction. It goes back to what I said before about our fellow who needed to borrow $1,000 from his brother, to the interference. What makes noise when the connection is not perfectly smooth? When there's a little bit of an obstruction, a little bit of a disconnect, that's when things are making, sorry about that, that's when things, see, we speak about communication too much, we get phone calls. That's, as MCI is saying, you're stealing our gig here. That's when friction, that's when noise comes in. So why does the fire make a lot of noise? Why does it crackle? Why does the log make a lot of noise when you're burning it? Because a log is not attuned. A log is not, I'm going to use a Yiddish word. A log is not edel. You know what edel means? What does edel mean?
Refined.
A log is not refined. It's a thick piece of tree. It's not refined. Fire is very refined. Fire is one of the four primary elements. And fire is the element. Fire is the one element that is considered the most spiritual of all the elements. The four elements are earth, wind, water, and fire. Earth is heavy. Wind also has a certain weight to it. Water certainly is, although it's a liquid, but it also flows downward. Fire is the only element in existence that its physical nature is to soar upward. It always strives to unexist itself, to not exist. Fire is always striving to burn itself out of existence. You light anything on fire, you know what it does? You light this paper on fire. What would it do? What would the fire do? Burn it up. Why? Understanding this in Kabbalistic terminology, because the fire does not want to be here. The fire does not want to exist. And now they're trying Chabad. So the fire does not want to exist from the office back then. I'm telling you, that's now Ma Bell after us. The fire, it'll stop. It's right up there. The fire does not want to exist. So what it does is it burns its way out of existence. You're trying to hold it to something. It says, let me destroy it. Let me get rid of it. Now it keeps on rolling. I don't know why, because it gets kept on. It's being blown by the wind. It's being pulled by stuff. But it wants to obliterate its fuel. Yeah, it wants to obliterate its physical handle, if you will, and then disappear. Because when it finally consumes whatever it's burning, there's no fire anymore. Fire is the one element. No matter how you turn a candle, the flame is always upward. It's always pointing upward. Everything else works with gravity, right? Everything else pulls down. There's inertia. Everything flows down. Fire is the only element that goes up. And it's the only element that ceases to not exist. So fire is the most spiritual. It's the most ethereal. A log is not like fire. A log is very loggy. A log is very physical and material and coarse and, in Yiddish, grub. You know what grub means? Not food grub, but it's grub. It's coarse, unrefined. Fire is refined and a log is unrefined. So what happens when you put fire to a log? The log is burning, but it's resisting. And because it's resisting, you know what it does? It makes a lot of noise. Things make a lot of noise. You're dragging the log into consumption, into fire, kicking and screaming, which is why it makes a lot of noise. Contrast this with oil. Oil is considered to be a refined substance. Kabbalah speaks at length about oil. Oil contains secrets. It comes from the inside. It's pulled outside. But it's the essence of everything. The essence of everything is oil, which is why we call them essential oils, etc. Everything has oil at its core. So the point is, oil is more refined. It's not as refined as fire. But when you put fire to oil, the oil is okay with having fire cleave to it. And therefore, the oil burns calmly and serenely. So picture a log and picture oil. One is popping and crackling and fighting. And the other one is calm. Why? Because one is not used to this, like our fellow at the table who hasn't had a good meal in a while. And the other one is used to this. It's right up its alley, like the wealthy man who has this every single day. So when something makes noise, what it means is it's not its comfort zone. It's not its way of being. What does this mean for us? There are two types of individuals. Well, there are many types of individuals, but two general types that we speak of in Kabbalah and Chassidus. Although in Tanya he talks about three dimensions, but typically we can just kind of compress it into two. There is the tzaddik, and then there is the Baal Teshuva. These are categories that we've spoken about many times before. The tzaddik is the perfectly righteous individual, and the Baal Teshuva is someone who is not always so perfect, has not always been perfect, but is trying to do his or her best. So the tzaddik is perfection, and the Baal Teshuva is struggle. Which one do you think makes noise? Tzaddik doesn't make any noise. In the tzaddik service of God, the tzaddik makes no noise. Because serving God is perfectly attuned to the tzaddik's disposition. The tzaddik wants to serve God. And that service then flows cleanly and freely and smoothly and purely. The tzaddik prays and does a mitzvah. And it's serene. It's like that oil lamp. What about the Baal Teshuva? Baal Teshuva would rather be playing golf, but is now at synagogue, at shul.
Is the Baal Teshuva the same as Binyoni?
The Baal Teshuva is, you can kind of correlate the Baal Teshuva and the Binyoni, yeah. So the Baal Teshuva is someone who might rather be somewhere else, or let's put it this way, in the past has acted in a contrary way, if you will. In other words, in the past has done things that have been the opposite of the mitzvah opportunity right now. And so when the Baal Teshuva engages in the mitzvah and serving God, whatever that is, whether it's prayer or whatever, the Baal Teshuva makes more noise. Baal Teshuva makes more noise because it's not as perfectly seamless with his or her disposition. Does it make sense? Take a look at this. Text number 7. Along these lines. Who are we up to? Sarah, did you read?
Yeah.
You did read. Karen, I think we're up to... Yeah.
An impressionable soul that expresses itself in a scream indicates great pain. By contrast, an impressionable soul that expresses itself in a silent manner indicates a sense of yearning. In other words, both reactions stem from deep within the heart, accompanied with wailing and bitter tears. The difference is that one expresses itself with a scream in great commotion, whereas the other expresses itself silently. This is the difference between the efforts of Baal Teshuva versus the efforts of the heartfelt and devout. Surely they both stem from a deep place in the soul, but they vary in their nature and purpose. One who flees from death does so with a great cry, a bitter scream. This is different from the one who serves God with a heartfelt sense of piety. The latter is the soul expressing its desire to draw closer to God, for she feels the intensity of God's greatness. This sort of expression is silent. The efforts of the Baal Teshuva stem from a sense of pain, the pain of the soul that senses her distance from God. This expression is one that comes with great commotion.
So here we have this a slightly different analogy, but coming from a place of distance, there's a greater commotion. The Baal Shem Tov adds another layer to this, and he gives the example of somebody who is, God forbid, drowning in water. David, please read this one, text number 8, page 149. David.
When a person is drowning in water, they feel flail around in the water, which is much motion, indicating to others to save them from the water. Surely those who see this person wouldn't ridicule their gesture. So too, one who prays and makes gesture should not be ridiculed for their rescuing themselves from an evil flood, the rush of souls that seek to distract them from their prayers.
So the Baal Shem Tov is talking about somebody who prays with a lot, very animated. Somebody says, why are you, what's with all the commotion? So he says it reflects a struggle inside. Someone's feeling the struggle. They're feeling the opposition. They're feeling the waters that are threatening to drown them, even as they're praying and they're trying to push away distracting thoughts. It takes a commotion. Someone who doesn't have that dissonance between who they are inside and what they're doing on the outside, the mitzvah they're doing on the outside, so it flows calmly and serenely. But someone where there's some friction there, friction causes noise. And so here we get to an incredible insight. The high priest serving in the temple, in the Mishkan, serving in the tabernacle, and then later serving in the Beit HaMikdash, who did he represent? The high priest himself, we assume, was a tzaddik. He himself was pure. He was the oil. He was the wealthy man. He was the fellow who's not flailing around while he's praying, right? He was pure. But who did he represent? Who did he represent? There's a halacha in Jewish law. There's a Jewish law that says that someone who is the shliach tzibur, someone who represents the congregation, the cantor, and I point over here because that's where we usually have the chaz and the cantor. So someone who represents the congregation has to have in mind that he is representing the entire congregation with no exceptions. If there's anyone that he's thinking, I'm representing everyone except for so-and-so, then no one is represented. It's either all or nothing. So shliach tzibur, he's an emissary of the tzibur. Tzibur means the community. But here's something else. You know what else tzibur stands for? Tzadik bet resh. Tzadikim beinonim reshaim. Three levels of people. The purely righteous, the intermediary, and the ones that need some more improvement. Tzibur stands for Tzadik Beinoni Rasha. In other words, a congregation is made up, a real congregation is made up of everyone. And the one representing, who does he represent? Everyone. When the high priest served in the temple, who did he represent? Only people like him? Only perfectly pious, righteous people? No. He represented also the noisy amongst the people. Also those that when they do a mitzvah, there's a lot of noise because it comes with a lot of dissonance and a lot of friction. It's not always what the person wants to do. So it's a noisy experience. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, serving in the temple each and every day, the whole day wore bell bottoms. Why? To remind him and to declare before God that even the noisy are being represented. Maybe they're at the bottom of the hem, but they're represented. So when I say bottom of the hem, of course not. But even if somebody might say, oh, those are... Everyone is represented. Everyone is represented in the temple. And now you understand, now you can understand why he didn't wear this on Yom Kippur. Why? Let's flesh this out, and then I want you to come up with the answer. This is all the Rebbe's insight into this detail. Again, let's set this up one more time, and then I'll ask the question again. The high priest served in the temple each and every single day with bells ringing, making noise. Why? To indicate that his service is on behalf of everyone, even those who are maybe a little bit distant from, you know, perfection. So that when they do a mitzvah, there's a lot of commotion because it's not so pure and natural. But even they're represented. So tell me now, why in Yom Kippur did he not wear any bells? That's right. Because on Yom Kippur, everyone's elevated to a tzaddik. Everyone wears white. And everyone fasts. and everyone is atoned, and everyone becomes a tzaddik on Yom Kippur. So he's not representing any noisy people. There's no one's noisy on Yom Kippur. There's no noise in Yom Kippur. So when he goes into the Holy of Holies, when he goes into the holiest space, at the moment that the core inner essence of a person is brought out, which totally negates any type of friction and any type of challenge, at that moment, when the high priest enters the Holy of Holies, everybody is elevated to a higher level. At that point, there's no need to wear any bells because everyone is a tzaddik. But the rest of the year, indeed, it can be a challenge sometimes, and the high priest is representing everyone. Yes. It's really always directly. We all have a direct channel.
So
the high priest, though, helps. It's not that the high priest, I would say like this, it's not that the high priest is standing between. It's kind of like pushing us from below. Like, come on, you can do it, right? It's like a Sherpa. To forge that connection. Yeah.
And
there's less friction. That's the point. The rest of the year, there's friction. So the friction has to be represented with noise and bells.
Yeah.
But in Yom Kippur, there's less friction. There's no friction. We're elevated. So that's why there's no bells. But every other... Now, based on all of this, it would seem that the bells represent the least ideal, the less ideal, right? The low, I don't like using this terminology, but, right? Someone who's not yet where maybe the ideal is. And the point of the wearing the bells is that even they are represented. They shouldn't feel excluded. Never think that you don't have a place in the temple, in the high priest's service, etc. You're there on the me'il. And if he doesn't wear it, it could be fatal for him if he doesn't represent you, so to speak. But that's what we said until now. Of course, we have the Talmudic teaching of text number 12. Adina Malka, please read text 12. Oh, you'll pass. I'm sorry. What am I thinking? Text 12. Alex, please read this one.
Rabbi Abahu said, in the place where the Baal Teshuva stands, the completely righteous cannot stand.
And now the Talmud says something different. The Talmud says you should know that not only is the Baal Teshuva also accepted, you might think that maybe he does not represent it. He's also represented. Not only that, but Makom Shebaal Teshuva Omdim, Tzadikim Gemorim Einam Omdim. Where the Baal Teshuva stands, the Tzadik cannot touch. And what that means for us is that the Baal Teshuva stands, again, not that we should be ranking people, but at a higher degree than even the tzaddik. Why? Because and it's similar to what we said before, because the Baal Teshuva is serving God with noise and passion and excitement. Whereas the tzaddik, who's never tasted any type of sin, any type of challenge, any type of friction, the tzaddik does so, serves God calmly and serenely and purely. The Baal Teshuva makes a lot of noise. And not only are we allowing the Baal Teshuva a place in the temple, on the contrary, the Baal Teshuva has the highest standing. The Baal Teshuva is even greater than the tzaddik. Why? Because noise equals energy and excitement. What would you rather watch? Would you rather watch a crackling fire at the campsite or a lamp, a boring oil lamp, just serenely burning? It's boring. Where do you want to tell a story around? That's why even in our homes, we put in fireplaces. What do you burn in the fireplace? Oil? Who has an oil fireplace? I have a gas fireplace, so who am I to talk? So I guess it is, huh?
That's what most of us have.
It's the fake stuff, right? But even then, they put fake logs. Because we know that what do you want to see? You want to see the log. You guys have a fireplace?
Yeah.
Real one or fake one?
Fake gas.
Yeah, that's the worst, right? I mean, it's great, but it's... How high do you put it on? I'm always concerned that I'm going to burn something down. Anybody else concerned about this?
Yeah, our pearl water is like doesn't actually generate much heat.
Yeah, no, totally. Mine, not either. Yeah, it's the worst. Anyway, but a log would be awesome. And a log we want to watch because a log makes noise. It's exciting. You never know what you're going to get, right? It's psh, crackles. It's this. So the message here is not only is the Baal Tshuva also represented by the Kohen Gadol, by the high priest, but the Baal Tshuva stands at an even higher level. And the message for us is to make a lot of noise. It's good to make noise. And it's even if it's coming from a place of friction that we're not always totally on board, so we have to push ourselves and it's difficult and whatever, but God loves that. God loves it. It's like the author of writes, the difference between sweet food and spicy food. Sweet food is easy. It doesn't take any chachma to like sweet food. It doesn't take any, you don't have to have a palate, a sophisticated palate to like sweet food. Kids love candy. It's sweet. It's natural. They like sweet. But something spicy, something that challenges you, something that it like hurts. Ah, but it's geschmack. It's beautiful. It's delicious. That's what this is. That's what this is. The Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, when Yitzchak says to his son, he thinks he's, well, he says to Esav, he says, prepare me mitamim, something in the plural, different foods, tasty foods in the plural. So he says, what does this tell us? That there's two types of foods. There's sweet food and spicy food. The sweet food is the tzaddik. The spicy food is the beinoni or the Baal Tshuva. And that, in a sense, is even higher. So the message for us is embrace the bonfire. I feel like that should be a bumper sticker. Embrace the bonfire. Embrace the noise. Embrace the crackling. Embrace the popping. It's a beautiful thing. It means that we have energy in our divine service. It's not like, oh yeah, this is calm and serene. There's energy. There's passion. And God loves it too. Therefore, when you're trying to reach the Jew on the street who thought, like your son did, he was going to work, he was at work, he was... What was the context?
They were walking, you know, they were walking down the street. Well, you mean when he saw the...
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. When he saw the...
Yeah, was it work? Was it,
work,
he was working.
Yeah.
So he thought that he was working. You're trying to reach the Jew on the street who is there because... You know, there's work happening. Not at all religious, Jewish, spiritual. Like, totally different objective. Totally different agenda. But here you have a neshama. Here you have a soul. So how do you reach a Jew on the street? You got to reach a Jew on the street with noise. You got to make noise. You can't reach... You're not gonna bring out the fire in the log with oil. It's not going to work. You have to bring noise to the table. You have to do it in a noisy fashion. So you go out with the mitzvah tanks, larger than life vehicle, right? You go out with a huge, massive RV, retrofitted. You put the speakers on the outside, and you play some Hasidic tunes, blaring, and everyone's like, "What is happening here?" You make noise. And then you go out and you ask people a question about their religious identity. Hey, are you Jewish? Do I know you? Doesn't matter, right? I ask you a question. Come, let's do a mitzvah. Wrapped tefillin, light Shabbat candles, etc. So this is, not light Shabbat candles on the street, but take some to light Friday evening. This is the message. This is the call. This was the Rebbe's message. So again, now we understand the high priest, the me'il, the robe, the bells making noise, representing everyone, even those that make noise. Not only even those that make noise, but especially those who make noise, because that's the highest. In a sense, that's what God loves. God loves the noise. And to reach the noise, you got to make noise. And of course, a thought that I've mentioned many times, that you've heard from me, I'm sure, many times. Today, we hear a lot of noise in the world about negative things. Let's make some noise in the positive. Thank you very much for joining me for Torah Studies.